We have to talk about what's going on with COVID-19 because we're watching the number of infections among teenagers and children skyrocket nationwide. And with more on this, let's bring in Anjali Kamlani, because the CDC is still upping its game when it's talking about what all of us can do to protect youngsters. Bring us up to speed.
That's right. We're getting a lot of information in the past few hours here from the federal government, all geared towards protecting more Americans. First of all, the Surgeon General coming out with a warning to protect children. We've seen ICU numbers, especially in the pediatric ward, skyrocket in the last several weeks, and really concerns about that, the hospitalizations and the rising death toll of kids, some attributing it to in-person in schools, while others saying it is just a result of the virus spreading as naturally as possible through the unvaccinated population, which unfortunately includes the entire under 12 population of the country. Meanwhile, we also know that the White House is weighing the idea of reducing the need for an additional dose. Again, the debate about whether it's a booster or not, but reducing that to 5 months after the first course rather than the previous six, which was based on data, and the previous eight, which was the initial announcement. So a lot going on there, and maybe we do hear something sometime soon. And we know that the advisory committee for the CDC is also set to meet soon to talk about boosters. So waiting to hear more about that.
It's good to see you. So starting with that encouraging news out from J&J, I guess, what's your take on the data that we got today?
I think it's very good. I think all the vaccines, the messenger RNA, as well as the Johnson & Johnson, are going to be very helpful with boosters. I personally think probably the eight-month timetable after the last shot you've had is going to be the sweet spot in getting the booster. We know now that some of the patients who are immunocompromised need it sooner.
When we hear these stories about the people in the hospital, the majority of whom in the hospital, unfortunately not vaccinated, there are the cases of people who are breakthrough cases. And then there was an individual on television on a different network talking about having a breakthrough case and really difficult symptoms. Do we know the severity of what happens if you are vaccinated, but you still get this variant?
Yes, we do. Right now, our hospital is overwhelmed in Montgomery, Alabama, and all across the state. We have no ICU beds. 95% of the patients in the hospital are unvaccinated. Of the 5% or so that have been vaccinated, most of them have are immunocompromised, either chronic renal disease or something like that. Extreme obesity is a huge factor of not doing well, even if you're vaccinated.
Doctor, what are you seeing on the pediatric level? Because I was just reading today, there's a record number of children in hospitals right now nationwide. And I know you're seeing a lot down in your state of Alabama, too, that are becoming a little bit more sick than they were in previous months with the Delta variant. Can you talk about just how big of a risk this variant is to children?
Sure. Now, I'm not a pediatrician. Let me start with that. But this time last year, 1% of the cases, new cases of COVID were children. Now it's up to about 23-24%. A lot of kids are getting infected, and a lot more are going to get infected as we go back to school. Most children do very well. Oh, you know, a great majority do very well. But having said that, as a few days ago at UAB, which is our big university hospital in the children's hospital, which is associated with them, had about almost a dozen children on ventilators. So it's a real problem.
You know, you're a pulmonologist. You understand the issues better than anybody. I want to back up very quickly because you are right now in the center of the storm where the medical staffs of places like New York were a year ago. How are you and your team holding up?
Well, I'll be honest with you, it's very emotionally and physically draining. It's really tough for our nurses. I've been working in ICU for 38 years. I've always known all my ICU nurses. I go into units now, and I don't know a single soul because my nurses are sick. They're home quarantined or they're ill with the COVID, and I'm seeing traveling nurses. And it's exhausting. We didn't think we was going to do this again this winter.
And doctor, this has also pulled into question the timing of all this and what needs to be done in order to get COVID under control. Dr. Fauci was out saying they might not be until springtime of 2022, but there's still a lot riding on that because a lot of that has to do with the number of people who do get vaccinated. What do you think of the timeline? And I guess what more can be done to reach those? Because there's a large number of people in your state of Alabama who are refusing to get vaccinated.
That's exactly right. And a lot of those are young people. Most of the older people are vaccinated. Now, that's changing right now because everybody in the hospital primarily are young people. I've got several 20s, 30s, and a few 40-year-olds on ventilators, critically ill. So the vaccination rate is going up slowly. There's a lot of misinformation out on the vaccines. And you got some doctors who are discouraging vaccinations. That's a shame. I'm not sure when this thing is going to end. But one thing we could do to solve the problem right now is use the monoclonal antibodies, which I know y'all have been talking about. That's the golden goose right now that's going to keep people going to the hospital.
I can't help but notice that you have around your neck and then in front of you what I would imagine is a pretty good mask. What would you say? I wish I had one of those. That just would be great for Halloween when we are post this pandemic. But yeah. What would you say? I'm thinking of Darth Vader right now, but what would you? And you're certainly not. We are grateful to the work you're doing. What would you say to the governors of states where they've politicized the mask issue?
You know, it's a shame. Masks has not hurt anybody. They clearly help. I mean, how much flu did you see last year? None. You know, masks work. And it's not a big deal. You know, it's a shame it's become such a political issue. That's all I can say. We're not going to have a mask mandate in Alabama, and most southern states are not. You know, we're kind of don't want the government to tell us what to do. But having said that, nobody has a problem wearing a seatbelt and, you know, not walking in a restaurant without shoes.
Doctor, we have the news today. Moderna completing its submission for full FDA approval of its vaccine. Pfizer getting full approval earlier this week. This has led to a number of companies mandating vaccines. Is there any reason employers shouldn't be mandating vaccines at this point?
Well, you know, that's another political hot potato there. I wish everyone was mandated to have the vaccine. You know, it's a political problem, particularly in the Deep South. We're conservative people. I'm a conservative person. I don't want the government telling me what to do, but this is one for the common good.
You know, it's interesting because you brought up the issue that seems to be at the center of politics. We hear on different TV interviews, people say, I just don't trust it. I just don't trust it. But your seatbelt analogy, I mean, not you don't want to be insulting to people who are concerned, but these vaccines have been in development for two decades, right? I mean, mRNA is not new technology.
That's exactly right. People said, well, I don't want to use it. It was developed too soon. No, we've been working on this thing, like you said, almost two decades. And we've had the formula, if you will, ready when we got the DNA sequence from the Chinese. And I think like January the 18th, in 2 days, we knew what to do. The whole 9 months before it was approved was simply testing. We had the quote formula, if you will, early on, but it's been a two-decade journey. And this technology is going to be game-changing for a lot of things, including cancer in the future.
The COVID-19 situation continues to be dire in the U.S., with an increasing number of businesses mandating vaccinations as infections rise. U.S. government data have now shown that hospitalizations of COVID patients in their 30s hit a new record as the especially contagious Delta variant spreads. Here to provide an update on the ongoing health crisis is Dr. Marco Sanchez Gonzalez, adjunct professor in Lake Erie College of Osteopathic Medicine's Masters of Health Services Administration and Public Health. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. And I first want to ask, what has the situation been like right now where you are in Florida, especially given the state's soaring COVID cases recently?
Well, the situation is becoming very critical, especially for the healthcare system, because as many people get sick at the same time, that means that the capacity of hospitals start to be limited. We have some cases and in some institutions that some of the patients has to be displaced to accommodate new COVID patients. So you add that to the fact that many of these COVID-19 patients, the length of stay is over a 7, maybe 14 days, we are creating that bottleneck effect that it's definitely starting to put some strain in the system. And right now, the situation is that even if we can achieve 100% vaccination, we're not going to see the effects of that in less than 35, 45 days, but it takes to the vaccines to make their full effect.
Do we know yet what is it about the Delta variant of COVID-19 that is impacting so harshly on children other than not being vaccinated? Because they seem to have had a resistance to the original COVID.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Mechanistically, what is being shown in many studies is that this virus, this Delta, has a very good affinity to the receptors for infection. So meaning that it makes it easier to get infected. When that happens and it's easier to get infected, you will be able to get, or the virus will be able to get to children that are more susceptible to it, especially those that have other comorbidities. Interestingly enough, many of these children-related hospitalizations are similar to other viral illnesses. So shortness of breath is there. Many of these kids are hospitalized for complications owing to dehydration, for instance. So it's a combination of, yes, it's a variant that is more infectious, and yes, it's spreading faster to kids that are potentially more susceptible to it.
And just in terms of the hospitalizations and the severe cases that you've been witnessing in your area, what proportion of those have been among the unvaccinated versus the vaccinated populations?
So roughly, I want to say the ratio started roughly 95-90% unvaccinated. But as we go into this, that number is starting to decrease. That was predicted via the models of the immunity, because the vaccines were basically designed for the Wuhan virus variant. And yes, they still provide some protection for this variant. But as I mentioned before, when you have a faster spreading of a viral illness, you are going to get to those susceptible faster. We have a very important number of patients that are unvaccinated. But even if we reach that 100%, there's a very short chances that we are not going to have hospitalizations, because as the vaccines, they don't prevent the spread. They don't prevent the infection. They prevent some of the severe cases. So right now, one of the measures that we need to start thinking, it's to apply more robust models to follow patients from the primary care perspective and start early treatments that has been mentioned before by the CDC, with some of the treatments that are already approved, such as a monoclonal antibodies, that probably we can ease 15-20% of those patients. They are not reaching the hospitals. That will basically help us to ameliorate the burden in the healthcare system.
What information, if any, are you within the healthcare industry and field getting about other variants which may be emerging? Not the Delta variant, but others, because we keep being told that people who are not vaccinated are a breeding ground for new variants.
Okay. So there is not evidence to suggest that has anything to do with vaccination status. Basically, any variant will find an individual and will escape that immune system, whether that individual is immunized or not immunized. So vaccination doesn't mean immunization. And that's another concept that we need to start putting out there, because we can have a vaccinated individual that still is not immune because it hasn't mounted the response to the virus, as opposed to other individuals that they may have resistance to the disease, natural resistance. I'm not saying that they have more protection, but there's some people that is simply not susceptible to it. The viruses will find those individuals that appear not to get sick, and they escape that immune surveillance, whether it's that vaccine-induced or naturally. And those are the variants that jump into individuals that, yes, definitely will get more susceptible to it.
Dr. Marco Sanchez Gonzalez, adjunct professor in Lake Erie College of Osteopathic Medicine's Masters of Health Services Administration and Public Health. Thank you.
The number of children hospitalized with COVID-19 in the U.S. just hit a record high as the highly transmissible Delta variant continues to spread. Joining me now is Dr. Cedric Dark, assistant professor at Baylor College of Medicine and board member with Doctors for America. Dr. Dark, it's always good to see you. I know that you are there in Houston, and Texas is right now a hotbed. You've got surging cases of COVID-19. Hospitals are stretched thin. Kids are going back to school, and the Texas Supreme Court has blocked mask mandates that two of the counties there in Texas were fighting for. Tell us what you're seeing right now in your area on the ground.
Well, right now in the hospitals, it's pretty packed. There's a very difficult time trying to get patients from the waiting room, from the front door, into hospital beds. A colleague of mine just last night told me that he had heard word that a hospital in Texas had tried to transfer a patient to him. He lives all the way on the East Coast, 1,500 miles away. And I've heard stories like this from other doctors in other parts of the country where they're trying to get patients out of the Deep South and into places that have open beds. We just don't have that available.
And what is the situation in terms of children in your area right now? I mean, we're hearing these really disturbing reports of the number of children getting sick and children now being hospitalized on the rise, something we didn't see with this virus months ago, but it seems to be what's happening with this new variant. And of course, doctor, we know these are the most vulnerable among us at the moment because children under 12 cannot yet get the vaccine.
Right, exactly right. We're at a point where this is one of the highest levels we've ever seen children being hospitalized in this country as a result of this. Over the weekend, there were about 4 ICU beds available in our pediatric hospital for children in a 9-county region that covers about 6.6 million people here in Texas. And when you think about it, children under 12 can't protect themselves from this. You know, they can't get vaccinated. It's up to our leaders to act like adults and actually protect our kids. And the only way you can do that, especially as kids are going to school, is to make sure that then not only are they wearing masks, but their teachers are wearing masks. And if you're an employer, if you run the schools, make sure that your employees are vaccinated. Teachers' jobs are to protect their students and to educate their students. They should be vaccinated as well.
Speaking of that, Live Nation, which runs a bunch of different concerts and concert venues across the country, announced that they're going to mandate that anyone going to a concert, working behind the scenes at a concert, needs to show proof of vaccination beginning October 4th. I heard that and I thought, that sounds a little late given the situation we're in right now. What do you make of this mandate by Live Nation? Should we be seeing more organizations do this? And is October 4th too late? Because I know there are concerts scheduled. I mean, we had Lollapalooza just recently in Chicago take place, although they did require vaccinations there. But what do you make of what they're doing there at Live Nation?
Well, better late than never. I'd rather see it moved up. There's no reason it couldn't be moved up right now. Pretty much anybody over the age of 12 is eligible to be vaccinated at this point in time anyway. And if you're going to have an event like that, an event like Lollapalooza, thankfully it was outdoors. Thankfully there was a vaccine mandate so that you had about 90% of the people in attendance from what I've seen were actually vaccinated. And hopefully that will keep their numbers down in terms of spreading COVID. But, you know, again, if private industry, private businesses don't implement these mandates because in some places the states are not allowing them. It's really up to individuals to take care of themselves by vaccinating, by wearing masks. It's up to private businesses to make sure that their employees and their customers are protected as well. Because otherwise, what will happen inevitably is you'll wind up seeing me in an emergency department. And I worked over the weekend on what we call an MSC shift. It's a shift where I'm out in the triage in the waiting room seeing patients, and I can see them in a chair. You know, a chair is still a chair, and I can see patients sitting there, but a chair is not a bed, and a bed is not a staff bed when there's no nurse there to staff it, right? So what I'm saying is people need to do what they can, be a part of the solution instead of part of the problem, so that we don't wind up seeing the overflow and the onslaught of patients coming to see us in the emergency department.
Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of Lollapalooza, I read that about 12% of the attendees admitted they got the vaccine so that they could attend Lollapalooza. So I guess there's some evidence that mandating these things is helping get more people vaccinated. If you want to do that particular thing badly enough and you need to get vaccinated, you will. Do you think that we're just going to be seeing more and more of that until we reach herd immunity? And by the way, doctor, what do we consider herd immunity these days? Because I had heard early on it would be 70 to 75%. It seems like it needs to be much higher than that now.
Yeah, the herd immunity question is something that would be very difficult for me to answer. You said it right. I think we were thinking around 75% to 80% might be the way to go, but we really don't know. Every virus is going to be different to figure out how many people need to be vaccinated to stop the transmission from person to person. You know, ultimately, incentives are what is going to get us out of this. And if we can't do mandates, you know, at the federal or state level, it's going to be the incentives that our private industry partners put up. If you want to fly in an airplane on United Airlines, you need to be vaccinated. And as a frequent flyer of United Airlines, I'm very happy that they do that. If you want to go to a movie theater or to a concert, if those private businesses want to implement mandates, that's great, because then you can create a safe space for people during this pandemic where the risk of them becoming infected from another customer or from an employee of that business is as low as possible.
Real quick, doctor, hearing anything about boosters? When might we see them and who might get them first?
So let's think a little bit about this in terms of boosters versus third shots. So right now, the guidance is if you are immunocompromised, those patients need to get a third shot. Let's not misinterpret that as a booster shot, which would be something for people that are already in a what we would call immunocompetent state, where they would be getting a shot later on, you know, something akin to an annual flu shot. We're not at that point yet. The data is still out. We're waiting to figure those pieces of data out, and we'll let you know as soon as we find out about the information.
We know you will, and we always appreciate it. Dr. Cedric Dark, always good to see you. Thanks so much.
Let's talk about back to school season, as students are heading back in just a couple of weeks, as administrators are contending with mask mandates and requirements and so much more. We have Yahoo Finance's education reporters, Aarti Swaminathan and Reggie Wade, here for a conversation with Laura Jimenez, Director of Standards and Accountability for K-12 Education at the Center for American Progress.
Hey, Laura, thank you so much for joining us. So I just want to start this conversation with, I'm here in California, and we know that over the past year, COVID has really disrupted learning. And as a result, some of the schools here have changed their grading policy. So I wanted to ask you first and foremost, what have you seen and how diverse have some of these schools been in adjusting grading for students?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think along with the general chaotic nature that we saw schools kind of take on when they were first closed, we've seen the same thing with grading. So for example, when it came to virtual learning, many experts, me included, were urging states to define what does a school day look like? How many hours in a school day? How many days a school week? To give local districts some structure regarding that. And that didn't really happen. And so I think we saw schools be designed across the gamut. And I think we saw a similar pattern emerge with grading. However, I would say many, many schools, the majority of them stopped grading toward the end of last year. And about half of them have picked up grading for this school year. And we've seen many instances in the media of the rise in the rates of students failing courses. And I think for me, that kind of begs the question, failing what?
Laura, Reggie Wade here. We see school districts in states such as Louisiana are thinking about scrapping letter and number grades as they've seen standardized test scores plummet. What do you think of that? Some folks say that we need to still hold our students accountable, even amid a pandemic.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think for me, the first question is how do we hold the districts accountable, the states and districts accountable for providing an adequate education and a quality education during the pandemic? And that might be the first place I would start instead of holding students accountable. Because we're also seeing lots of reports of students struggling with mental health issues. We also know that not all of them are adequately connected to learning. They lack broadband access. They lack a device. And under those conditions, you know, is it really fair to hold students accountable? I think is a question we need to be asking.
Laura, what happens with these students when they apply to college if you remove letter grades and standardized testing? Does it make them less competitive?
I think that's a great question. We don't quite know the answer yet. We did see a number of institutes of higher ed, many colleges, make the SAT or the ACT optional for this academic year. We did see, independent of the pandemic, the UC system was already making moves to make those tests optional for their systems. And I think we are at a moment in time questioning the value of those tests, at least in regards to college admissions, but also when it comes to school accountability. And that's definitely some work that I'm focusing a lot. How can we make assessment systems much better for our teachers and for our students?
Laura, you call for improving the quality of remote learning, but do you think there's much of an appetite for that in the U.S. with more and more people wanting to see their kids back in the classroom?
Well, I think what we are going to see, at least in the short term, is probably inconsistent return to full-time instruction in the classroom, especially as variants emerge. We are going to have some localities that do either all virtual or do a hybrid or make it optional for students to be in the building. And under those conditions, I do think that it is incumbent upon school districts to improve the quality of virtual learning, because there will be some portion of students, especially those who are Black and Latinx and Indigenous, who also suffer some of the greater impacts of the pandemic, to be learning from home.
And just quickly, I just wanted to ask you, in terms of global competitiveness, how are you thinking about the U.S. rankings? Do you think that we might sink a little bit lower this year, or do you think that it's just going to be a depressed year for all of the countries in the world?
That remains to be seen. We do know that the United States has middle-of-the-road rankings when it comes to an international assessment called the PISA. But that's kind of been a long-standing issue for the United States, as we've had academic standards that are pretty inconsistent state to state. And up until around 2010, when states adopted the Common Core standards, their standards were fairly low. So I think the issue of America's academic standing globally is an issue that is independent of the pandemic and certainly will have an impact. But like you said, I think we might be seeing some of that internationally as well.
Laura, do you think that we will see an emphasis put on teacher training coming through this pandemic? Because teachers are asked to do so much and they have so many different roles already. But some teachers, quite frankly, need to be trained on things of technology and remote learning, as we discussed. Do you think that will come out of this?
I hope that an emphasis on teacher professional development writ large is something that we come out of this on, when it comes to providing great instruction, being masters of the academic standards, using the available tools. The U.S. Is far, far behind the countries that outperform it on those international assessments in terms of providing evidence-based professional development to teachers. And frankly, we've got a lot of catching up to do.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance. COVID cases are continuing to rise, raising questions about how it will weigh on the return to school as students across the country wrap up the summer break. Dr. Lena Wen joins us as part of our series looking at the state of education as Americans get ready to head back to the classroom. She's also the author of Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Yahoo Finance's Anjali Kemlani also joins us for this conversation. And Dr. Wen, just so many questions to begin with here, but obviously a lot of these parents worrying about how the spread of the Delta variant may be affecting their kids as they get their backpacks ready for school. I guess just a baseline here, what is the risk as schools reopen and these kids who may not be vaccinated in most cases are possibly at risk of spreading it?
Well, first of all, great to join you today. I think it's important for us to level set and say that two things can be true at the same time. One is that it's really critical for us to get our kids back for in-person learning full time. And the second is that there is a way for us to do that safely. That said, there are also ways for us to do this unsafely, as in we know that the Delta variant is so contagious, it spreads so easily from person to person, especially among the unvaccinated. And there is definitely a risk if you have a lot of people who are unvaccinated together in an enclosed classroom for many hours a day, of course, you're going to have the risk of spread. But there are ways to prevent that from happening and to substantially reduce that risk. By this point, we know what works, and that's a combination of indoor mask wearing. It's a combination of having as many people as can be vaccinated to do so, improving ventilation, regular testing. All these are things that can and should be done. And the CDC guidance actually here is really important and very clear that it is important and we can get our kids back for in-person learning safely, but as long as we follow these mitigation measures.
Dr. Wan, Anjali here. Really great to have you back. I know that a lot of discussion has been happening about, you know, what the CDC has been saying, the guidelines have been coming out, and the state-level differences. Looking at a map, you can see just how differently this strain of the virus is affecting different states. So is there something to be said about, you know, with your experience as a public health commissioner, something that the CDC could be doing differently in order to help, you know, make the messaging maybe more straightforward while also balancing the various needs of different areas?
I think it's very challenging. And you mentioned earlier my book, Lifelines. I was the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. I oversaw school health in Baltimore for every one of our 180 or so public schools. It is really hard. Look, I think we need to start talking about COVID-19 and the vaccine the same way that we talk about other routine childhood immunizations. At the start of school in Baltimore, every single year, there are hundreds, if not thousands of families that have not met all the vaccination requirements. They're not anti-vaxxers. They're just families that, for example, have had other priorities. They didn't get around to this. There were other things that were really important. They're not anti-vaccine, but they needed that additional push in order to get vaccinated. This is where I think mandates are really helpful. Now, I'm not saying that we need school mandates for vaccines for kids at this point, especially since kids 12 and older or 12 and younger are not yet eligible to get the vaccine. Or 12 and older, you're eligible, but 11 and younger, you're not. But I do think that there are requirements that are needed at this point. And it really is unconscionable when we have governors at this point who are saying that they're not even allowing parents to have the tools necessary to protect their own children.
That's right, Doctor. And you're particularly talking about Florida and Texas, especially come to mind right now. Florida saying that they're not going to require students to wear a mask. Texas saying that they're not required, schools not required to do any contact tracing. And if you are in close contact with someone who's tested positive for coronavirus, you can still send your child to school. So I want to ask you about that vaccine mandate. Where does that bar really lie for you then when we should start saying, you know what, schools actually do need to start mandating that their children be vaccinated against coronavirus? I mean, parents are not new to having these vaccine mandates for other diseases and for other things. And especially once that vaccine is available for children 12 and under, do we need to really start thinking about mandating vaccines for all children that are going to schools?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we need to start with vaccine requirements for healthcare workers, for individuals working in nursing homes. And we are now seeing more and more companies implement vaccine requirements because that's in the best interest of their workers and their families and their customers as well. I think we need to normalize this for adults, and we have now been giving these vaccines to hundreds of millions of people around the world. We know that they are safe and effective. And then I think also that in schools, we should start at least implementing a testing requirement. For example, we can say that everyone needs to be tested at least once a week. But if you are vaccinated, if you're a teacher or a student that's vaccinated, you can opt out of that testing requirement. That's another very important push so that we are making vaccination the easy and convenient choice. And in the meantime, testing is also a layer of protection that's really important to help to keep these schools safe too.
Dr. Nguyen, in your book, you talk about basically your origin story and, you know, coming from an immigrant family and your experience with public health and with public assistance. I want to ask you, just looking back so far, what we've done and how the U.S. has dealt with the pandemic, what would you say is maybe a misstep or something that we still haven't yet hit on when it comes to looking at the most vulnerable of our population?
I'm glad you mentioned the most vulnerable because COVID-19 has certainly unmasked underlying health disparities. We've seen that it's not the virus that's discriminating, as in when we see unequal outcomes among Black Americans, Latino Americans, Native Americans compared to whites, when we see that people with low income are disproportionately affected by COVID. It's not that the virus is specifically targeting these groups. It's that our systems are unequal. We've also seen that unless we specifically address disparities, they're going to worsen. And so going forward, we need to do even more when it comes to vaccinations, testing, making sure that we're protecting those who are the most vulnerable. And I think another lesson coming out of all of this is how much it hurts our overall response when something that's as basic as mask wearing or vaccines become politicized. And I really worry about public health moving forward because we've seen now some state legislatures even limit the ability of health departments to respond in the future, as in if there are tuberculosis outbreaks or measles outbreaks. The public health powers of local health departments and state health departments are even more limited than before. So I really worry about the politicizing of public health and what this means for the ability of health departments to protect the people that they serve.
All right. Dr. Lena Nguyen, the public health professor at George Washington University and also the author of Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Thanks again for stopping by. Also, thank you to Yahoo Finance's Anjali Kamani for stopping by as well.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. As the back-to-school season approaches, a lot of questions are getting asked about vaccine requirements and what protocols might need to be put in place to protect students and whether teachers will face a vaccine mandate. For its part, one of the largest teacher unions, the American Federation of Teachers, says more than 90% of its members have already been vaccinated. And joining us now for more on that and the back-to-school push here is the president of that union, the AFT, Randy Weingarten, joins us now here alongside Yahoo Finance's education expert and reporter, Reggie Wade. Randy, good to be chatting with you again. Thanks for coming back on. I know you've been busy with a tour across the country with this push, the big campaign to get everyone back in school. Talk to me about what you're seeing in terms of preparedness and comfort levels out there, not just amongst parents, but teachers as well.
So thank you for asking that question. And look, as we were saying in the break, on July 1st, we were preparing for a very different school year than we're preparing for now, because of the Delta variant. We are preparing to be fully in school all across the country. I want to assure parents of that. This is where teachers are. They're rolling up their sleeves. They're calling parents. They're preparing 90, as you said, I would say over 90% now. Our polling showed that there was 89% of teachers who are either vaccinated or getting their vaccines by the end of March, early April. And because teachers know that in school is really, really, really important for kids, but we have to make it safe. And as a result, because of the virus surge, the variant surge, we got to take these, and I'm sorry, I'm looking for my mask. We got to, you know, put these masks back on in inside schools because our kids who are particularly 12 and under don't have access to the vaccines. But the real question becomes, you know, once we have kids in, how do we make sure that we are meeting with their social and emotional needs, and how do we accelerate instruction? And, you know, we've gotten a lot of money from the feds, from the American Rescue Plan, Biden's plan, to do a lot of this. And so there's a lot of planning for that as well. So safety and health concerns up front, obviously, masks, physical distancing, ventilation, get your vaccine, very important in terms of safety and health. But the emotional and social well-being is really important, as is the focus on instruction and academics.
Randy, Reggie Wade here. We've been hearing a lot about vaccine mandates for teachers. And are you open to that? And what would you say to folks who say that violates some teachers' personal freedoms?
Look, I don't see this as an issue of, I know there are a lot of people who see this as an issue of personal freedoms and not. What we see it as an issue of, what is the most efficacious way to create trust and agency in the entire school community? And that's, and teachers have been out there. I'm 1,000% in favor of vaccines. When I was a kid, we took a lot of vaccines before we could go to school. And it is a part of what you do, particularly when you have transmissible diseases, how you keep yourself, your family, and everybody else safe. So the issue has been, what is the most effective way to help keep everybody safe? And so now that the Delta variant is raging so much, there are some districts, there are some other employers that are saying, you know, is it time for us to do something for 100%, not 90%? And we are working with those districts. So in New York City, we have said yes to de Blasio's push for vaccines or testing. The same is true on the federal level with when Joe Biden has said that. And so we're looking and readjusting and seeing if, you know, what next steps we need to do for this, for making sure that everybody is safe. I've been reluctant personally because I know the firestorms that we have had on issues like CRT, on teaching honest history, on masking, which is, you know, on universal masking. And so when, you know, so that's why we have tried to get things done volitionally. But with the surging Delta virus, we are looking at and reconsidering everything.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like that's the key differentiator for you, Randy. I mean, it feels like you've kind of evolved on this issue of vaccine mandates. I mean, is it really about some of these alarming numbers that you're seeing that's led you to believe that vaccine mandates do need to be in place?
It's the numbers. It's not the, I mean, look, I get criticized or lauded every single day on social media, on, you know, just like other public officials, on, because you got to call balls and somebody has to, some people have to call balls and strikes based upon what the pandemic looks like, not based upon the politics. And so that's what we're looking at. We have heard over and over again from parents and from teachers and healthcare members that that they are waiting for, you know, the limited numbers who haven't gotten vaccines yet, many of them are waiting for full authorization from the FDA. They say that's what we normally have. So we need to do a better job in pushing back on the disinformation. But for us, the way we look at this is that this is a matter of how do we deal with a community virus that harms people. And that's why the issue about universal masking and kind of looking at the data now and seeing with alarm in terms of the Delta virus, that is what is leading to, you know, us looking at this again and seeing if, you know, more kind of mandamus as or requirements as opposed to doing it voluntary is in order.
Randy, you've been around the country visiting schools, and has it been tough for teachers to really focus on lesson plans and the pedagogy of teaching our children with all of this going around, with all the trepidation?
Yes. I mean, look, I represent teachers and nurses. You're seeing a huge number of people who are just at their wits' ends. I mean, think about this conversation right now. There's a focus on teacher vaccine mandates when 90% of the teachers have gotten vaccines. And instead of kind of lifting them up in terms of what they've done, the same in terms of nurses, they are spent and they are burnt out. And they now have yet another surge of the virus to contend with. So people want to be back in schools. There's a real, talking to teachers is a real joy, like in Albuquerque yesterday. It was a real joy talking to teachers about being in school and seeing their kids. That's why teachers become teachers. But, you know, the stress and strain is out there. There was a RAND report a few weeks that came out in June that showed that 78% of teachers had real stress from this year. That's double what the rest of the adult workforce. So teachers want to be with their kids. They want to do the right thing. They want to teach. We got to give them the tools and the conditions and a little bit of love for this.
Randy, the American Academy of Pediatrics had some pretty alarming numbers out in terms of COVID cases in children, an 84% jump over the last week, making up about 20% of new infections over that period. At what point do you think vaccines or vaccine mandates should be considered for children over the age of 12 when you consider there are plenty of vaccines that are mandated already for schools?
So this is, you know, I'm always reluctant to wade into this because the moment I say anything, we're going to have that, you know, that polarization. But I think that we have to be looking at how we make sure that every single student over 12 is vaccinated. I know a lot of this is going to be parental decisions. It's only 30% right now, which means that we've got to do a better job at helping all of our kids over 12 get vaccinated. There's a lot of misinformation out there. So our union is putting together, you know, we do a lot of vaccine clinics. I'm doing one in St. Louis on Saturday. We know that schools are trusted emissaries, but we also know pediatricians are trusted emissaries. As quickly and carefully and effectively as the FDA will get vaccines on the boards for kids who are two and older, and as quickly as there is full authorization, is I think when we can turn the corner on this, and because I am alarmed by this new data.
Yeah, I mean, the polarization around vaccines is interesting given, you know, the history of required vaccines in schools. But when you talk to the teachers, go ahead.
No, I agree with you. I mean, it is, you know, it's I'm sorry, you were asking the question. It's baffling to me.
The main thing is here. I mean, when we talk about teacher burnout, and you already referenced it, I had a friend who's a teacher who just quit last week because of all of that, too. When you look at the shortages now, though, as you kind of travel the country, how serious is the teacher shortage to actually get back into school and teach the same class sizes?
There's a big teacher shortage now. There's people are, you know, we're going to know more and more in the next few days. There's been, you know, this new jobs report. There's been more hiring back of educators and support personnel in 1 month than we've seen, I think, in decades. But we're hearing about, you know, the shortages that we normally have, special shortages for special ed teachers, shortages in bilingual, shortages in science and math. Those are getting more exacerbated. Shortages of school nurses, shortages of guidance counselors, they're getting more exacerbated. I'm hopeful that the feds, that Secretary Cardona, will start actually collecting data again so that we can have actionable data. You know, Betsy DeVos decided that, you know, none of the data that would actually really help us, you know, see what was really going on, it was not her thing, you know. So we hopefully will be collecting that kind of data. But anecdotally, you're hearing about shortages all over. But teachers are really spent. They have worked hard. It is not easy to teach on, remotely. What was really just impossible last year for both kids and teachers is hybrid, where half the kids are in your class. I mean, Reggie and I saw this when we went to White Plains with Secretary Cardona, that, you know, half the kids are on a screen, you know, five kids are in your classroom. And so if you're a teacher, it is not humanly possible to look at the screen and look at your classroom at the same time and help. Those are two different modalities. So teachers are really stressed, but they want to teach. They love their kids. That's why they do this, and they want kids to thrive.
Yeah, there are a lot of different issues here to tackle, and I know you're busy and kind of trying to make everybody happy here. But I appreciate you coming on here to chat with us, AFT President Reggie Weingarten, alongside Yahoo Finance's Reggie Wade as well.
Is opening schools,
and we're getting there. Appreciate you coming on here. Thanks again.